My name is Gary Butterfield.
My name is Cole Ross.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs Dispatch, our monthly Q&A topics, read your response, announce our games, jamboree.
Yeah, catch-all kind of deal. This month's dispatch is going to heavily favor questions, just as a heads up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not a lot of people had things to write in about the previous games. That happens from time to time. Mm-hmm. It is not a problem.
Not at all.
Since this is, we're going question-pilled, let's get into, you know what? Right here at the top, come watch us at Midwest Gaming Classic.
Please do.
We usually save that for the end, but we'll put it here. Mm-hmm. This will come out before then. We're going to be at Midwest Gaming Classic. Was it 7th, 8th, and 9th? Is that it? 6th, 7th, 5th?
So it is
4-2-1.
The first full weekend of April. So yes. We're going to be there from on April 6th and April 7th. So that is Saturday and Sunday.
Yes. Paneling at noon on Saturday is as of our current information, but regardless which we'll have a table, come by, pick up a couple of buttons and some stickers, say hi. Mm-hmm. We are nice. We're going to do a meetup. We will have information about that there. That'll be Saturday night.
Yeah.
The where's and exactly when's, still figuring that out, but it'll be that night.
Yeah.
Just show up at the table and we'll tell you where to go. Mm-hmm. And that's always a fun time. We just like hang out and drink beers and chat. With people in kind of little circles. It's nice.
Yeah. It's a little hangout.
It's easy. Yeah. So come check it out.
Please do.
Yeah. I'll get us started here with Steven. Steven says, do you have any experience with the game that holds the Guinness World Record for first video game rated 18 by the BBFC? BBFC is one of the predecessors of PIGI 18, the European age classification system for games. The game is called Jack the Ripper. It was developed by St. Bride's, pronounced Breed, St. Breed's, a.k.a. the Silver Sisterhood, a matriarchal cult that dressed in Victorian-era clothes and based itself in a small village in the northwest coast of Ireland in the 80s and 90s. Bonus fact, the Sisterhood wasn't even the first cult to use the premise that they lived in. When I learned of their story, I had to know if it was common knowledge. As always, love your work. Very grateful for all the hours of entertainment.
Huh.
What? The game is called Jack the Ripper. Is developed by the cult. The game isn't about the Silver Sisterhood. It's developed by the matriarchal cult.
Yeah. Designer of the St. Breed School. Was a new religious movement. That is cult.
Okay.
That was active in Burtonport County, Donegal in Ireland from 1982 to 1992. This was an Amstrad. It was like a micro PC game.
The answer to your question is no.
No, I was never aware of this.
Yeah, the answer and more bluntly, fucking of course not. but that does sound sick, and I'm looking forward to reading about it.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Mm-hmm. Thank you for bringing that to our knowledge.
Oh, the game accepts the input of full sentences, including the use of adverbs.
Ooh, Weird. Finally.
So,
adverb hounds. Buckle up.
So I don't just pick it up. I pick it up quickly.
Huh. Yes. Yeah, finally.
Weird. Let's see here. Gotham says, hey, gents, I found a surprising amount of fun playing RoboCop Rogue City. While the movement and shooting is super clunky and the attempts at immersive sim elements are paltry at best, what saved it for me is the flavor. Everything is spot on, from Peter Weller, the original actor from the film, voicing the protagonist, to the green and black computer screens, to the punks with their mile-high mohawks and shirts that say winners do drug. Despite its numerous shortcomings, you can really tell that the dev team had real affection for the source material and wanted you to really feel like you were RoboCop. I know many words have been said on the network, so I'm curious. When was the last time flavor/setting really carried you through a game, even if you might not have been a fan of what you were playing otherwise?
Oh, good. Good question.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to say. Mm-hmm. For me, because I don't get to play that many things outside of work.
Right. Stuff.
And when that's been true of things and the network, like we just will talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a good answer for that.
Yeah.
Do you?
Not necessarily. Like there are games where the atmosphere and stuff is, or the setting is a major part of why I enjoy it. bingo card here, Pathologic, right?
Right.
But I feel like
that's not the only thing you like about it.
Right. Yeah. Like, you know,
that's the part that's tripping me up is like, there are lots of things I like the atmosphere, but not, atmosphere is necessary, but insufficient for me.
Yeah.
I will never keep playing a thing
mm-hmm.
for atmosphere if I would quit it otherwise.
Yeah.
The
best I can say when I think about something that has atmosphere and little else is, well, at least there's that, right?
Like, yeah.
It would be hard for me, I think, to go back to Mega Man Legends without, like, I don't know, heavily modding it or streaming it or something like that in order mm-hmm. to make it play a little bit more, play a little bit better. But like, oh, I really dig like the tone and just kind of like feel of that game. Right. And that, yeah. and that world on that island. So there, at least there's that. Right.
Yeah. It's a thing I tend to be immune to. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't mean that I don't care about it. It's just, it's not, I never just play a game for it. It's the same thing with music.
Yeah.
Like whenever when anyone talks about like, oh man, you get to listen to that music. And I'm like, I can listen to music whenever I want.
Oh yeah. I use the YouTube cheat for that.
I use the YouTube cheat. And like, so like, yes, I care about the music in a game, but again, necessary, but insufficient
mm-hmm.
As a thing. That RoboCop game kind of came and went yeah. and I thought it looked awesome. Mm-hmm. I didn't get a chance to play it, but I was like, this feels like a weird throwback and it's taking RoboCop very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And RoboCop is one of the funniest ideas to take very seriously to me. And I that looked sick to me. So I at some point perhaps I will play that.
Have you seen the video that was going around? It's like a DVD
RoboCop shooting dicks off.
I mean, obviously that's a classic.
Yeah.
The video going around. I think it was like from a DVD extra. It was like a behind the scenes retrospective kind of thing. People complaining that Peter Weller would just shout Robo wants an Oreo.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah, just do a search for it. I don't want to do the entire bit because people just go see it. Yeah,
that makes me really happy. I'd like to feed RoboCop a single Oreo.
Yeah,
like you just pull back some skeleton fingers and you're grateful for it. Like,
yeah, Robo wants an Oreo. Just go look it up.
Phenomenal. Looking forward to that. And that to the task mask for today.
It's impossible to tell if it's a joke, mm-hmm. but it is the way it is played off is very good.
Adding it to my my Word document
yeah.
of stuff to do today, right in between dishes and ruminate on is the funniest name for a product ever. Taster's Choice. I think it might be.
It might maybe.
I woke up today thinking about Taster's Choice. Just like as a taster, hey, I like to make choices. This is the choice I make.
Hey, bud, you wrote that down as a to-do?
Yeah. No, that's a joke.
Okay.
That's not a to-do. It's just been on my mind.
Okay. I was like, so, that's not a to-do. That's a tweet, my bud.
Yeah. No, I'm trying to figure out. The to-do is to figure out if it is a tweet.
Okay.
If I'm just, woke up with brain worms or if that's actually as funny as I think it is. Like some people are tasters. Some people are not. And those tasters make choices.
Some people are tasters. Some people are choosers. A select few are both.
Yes. And this is their coffee. Greg says, what do you think about the potential and pitfalls of AI being used to make video games, as well as AI being integrated into games? Like many things in life, I'm inclined to say it's a double-edged sword. It can totally make some better games and some more engagement and believable enemies to fight and better stories and dialogue options, but can also allow for scams, lazy game making, and putting talented people out of work.
Yeah, that last one is way too important to me to override any positives. And like those positives seem really slim to vanishing. There was that video of Ubisoft demonstrating, here's an NPC that you can talk to. Like there's AI text to speech on your end. And then they spout back some of the blandest slop text imaginable. Hi,
yes.
I'm Jack something. I'll be your sidekick today.
The king lives in the castle.
Yeah.
I've seen the argument. I think it is a bad thing. Like, I think that, the network fit position is probably pretty anti-AI for this purpose.
Yeah.
Like, creative AI, right? Mm-hmm. Like, my understanding is, like, it can be useful if, say, you're trying to write code or something.
Yeah.
It can be really useful for that kind of thing. And, we talked about it before, it is good for shitposting. Like, it is good for just making a dumb idea.
Yeah.
As a thing. But I wish that was all it was,
mm-hmm.
Because once it goes past that, the labor stuff is, I think... insurmountably bleak.
Yeah.
I have no faith in companies, in people who hold money, who are putting money into this, to not use this for quick cash grabs and to put people out of work.
Mm-hmm.
Putting aside the fact that it's already stealing people's work, that's how it works. And I have never seen the upside. Like, every once in a while, somebody will show me an image that's created by AI, and it will be a good, creepy image.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But I don't like it more than if it had been hand-drawn by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no shortage of good, creepy images. The only difference here is somebody who hasn't put in the work or the talent was able to generate it based on it copying actual artists.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not seeing the upside. I've never seen anything where I'm like, this is fucking sick. This is good that this is AI.
Right.
Like, never. I don't know what the upside is for it that isn't just for the money men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least for me.
Yeah. And I think it's really important as people talk about AI. What's annoying to a degree is when they focus on the quality of the image. That is always going to change. It is always going to get better. Remember back in 2020 when people were, you know, putting these out, or maybe it was 2021, and it was like, you know, super fucked up, like little photo collage.
Biblically
kind
accurate
of things.
Everything.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and in 3 years' time, it's, you know, come to a point where it is, you know, fooling boomers the world over. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a little game. Like, you just look, you know, you try to spot.
Yes.
Them. And everyone has turned this into a game because that's how humans work.
Mm-hmm.
Parentheses derogatory.
Yes. So to go at it entirely on aesthetic grounds or just, you know, quality grounds, let's say, that is that's foolish. I think the conversation and the protest needs to be entirely on ethical grounds.
Labor is by far the biggest. It's the reason why I bring up any of the quality stuff is because you're trading it for nothing.
Yep.
You know, like if you take a look at what you are giving up, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of like dangers to labor and kind of the ethics of training a machine on actual people's talent without their consent to make it spit out facsimiles of that, like blended whiskey blends, you know, of everything they've ever done, that's a huge give. And you have to think about what you might get in return for that.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there are things that would justify it, right? Like it's not curing cancer though.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's making, people, it can make people money and can allow armchair people to feel like they're creating art.
Uh-huh.
In a way, and neither of those things are the reason why any of the quality comes up is because those are not things that are worth buying.
Yeah.
You know, the actual results are not worth anything that we're giving up for it. Mm-hmm. IMO.
Yeah.
I got a real big bias against it. And it's the kind of thing that makes internet strangers call you an NPC.
Yeah.
And shit. But it's just the case. I don't see the upside, and I think it's very troubling, and I care about labor.
Yeah.
Being a working artist is freaking hard.
to throw this out, you know, for people who are clamoring for nuance, although I would, you know, ask you to reconsider that, AI does have uses. Like, I have played around and sought solutions for, like, a way to do speech to text analysis on our episodes to make transcripts. It's not accurate enough yet. It's, you know, pretty bad. I've sought out AI to like automatically make show notes or give a starting point for show notes to like pull in every digression from Abject Suffering. That all seems pretty cool. That all seems fine to me. And that gets into accessibility stuff as well, which I think is important.
Sure.
The other thing is I'm not entirely against generative AI as an intermediate step for brainstorming or mocking up or just, you know, trying to in a low effort way, get a starting point from which to work.
I suppose, you know, like the former part of that I agree with. The latter part, I still think that's a little bit irritating.
Yeah.
You know, as a thing, because it's still just like, it feels cheaty and not cheaty the way that like I could just drive this nail in with my head. Why would I use a hammer? It feels cheaty because it's using the work of other people.
Yeah.
I'm just like, what do you do if you don't do that?
Right.
You know, what is the point of the person who, when they're designing a new thing, goes to ChatGPT and says, pitch me an interesting magic system for a fantasy world,
mm-hmm.
and then makes a couple of tweaks based on it and then puts out that thing. What is the point of you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you are not generating that idea, why do you deserve any credit for doing this.
Yeah.
You know, like there's too much art, the way that art is wrapped up in my head of like caring about the craftsmanship and artistry.
And the fact that like, it's made by somebody with something to say.
Yeah. And that person then is the person I'm communicating with. Mm-hmm. You know, that is the person who the art communicates with me through. Like, I am enough of a romantic where I care about that stuff very deeply.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I just feel like if you're giving that up, like, you're not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're no longer a writer. Like, you're no longer a musician. You're no longer a designer. Like, you're not doing the things anymore. You're telling a computer to give you a prompt, and a prompt, like, that's what you do. That's your whole, your point.
Yeah.
You know, that's what being an artist is. Like, you set and you suffer and you make that happen. Mm-hmm. You know, you set and you think, you brainstorm, you know, you talk to other people, you go out and get experiences in the world until you're inspired. Like, it's worked for thousands of years.
Yeah.
You don't just tell a computer to summarize human history, writing on human history, you know, to give you these things. I don't know. It just squicks me out.
Yeah.
Gives me, you know, as kids would say, the ick.
Yeah.
It gives me the ick real bad. None of my business. I'm too old for it. Fuck it. I don't need it. And this is the tool of the enemy. I do not need it. I will not use it.
Yeah, that's that's a good point. You know, I just it is a stretch to, you know, think about it as an intermediate step. But like, yeah, I totally see where you're coming
degrees.
From. There are degrees.
Like they're that is not as bad as just, you know, putting in like here, writing a bunch of AI books and selling them on Amazon.
Here's my AI Willy Wonka experience. Yeah.
Exactly. Or that guy's books that he wrote on Amazon.
Many of them. Yeah.
That were his. Yeah. Yeah. 16 books that he sold on there. That were just that AI wrote it. And like, what is the point of you? Like he wrote this big thing that was like, you know, oh, I lost the love of my life and I lost my career and stuff. And I'm like, what fucking career?
Yeah.
You were just a grifter. Like you got caught.
Yeah.
You know, how can I have sympathy for you?
Yeah.
You didn't do anything.
Yeah. Like, you didn't do anything. And the sword of Damocles that has hung over you for years, I do not understand how you actually existed with the stress of that.
Yes. Like, how do I have fucking imposter syndrome and you don't? Motherfucker. Like, how is it that every like great creator that I know in real life is down on themselves and struggles and this guy doesn't? Yeah, that's what AI does.
Yeah.
To me, it makes mediocre people feel like they can do stuff.
Yeah.
And they can, they just have to do the work.
Smash.
Fast.
That was a you question, so I'll read this one.
Oh, yeah.
Trent writes, I recently revisited Metroid Fusion on my Switch and was pleasantly surprised to rediscover that the game contains a few weird bat-winged mimics. Other standard gaming traps like teleporters, pitfalls, and poison swamps catch a lot of flack, but mimics seem to be fairly beloved. What is it about mimics that is so endearing? Are there any other stock enemies, traps, or tricks that put a smile on your face when you encounter them in a game?
Mimics are great because they surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's kind of like a joke or a jump scare.
Yeah.
When that happens. And good mimic design, you won't die
mm-hmm.
from the mimic right away. You know, the like one of the best mimics is the skeleton that just stands up in one motion out of a treasure chest in Kingsfield.
Yep.
And like, you can fight a skeleton.
Yeah.
It's no big deal. It's just like a delightful little surprise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of traps don't actually feel like surprises that way.
Yeah.
You know,
mimics also, there is oftentimes, at least since Dark Souls, a way to tell, you know?
Yes.
And that I think adds a crucial element of fairness to it.
Yeah. And a little bit of like making you pay more attention,
mm-hmm.
you know, it gives you a paranoia.
Yeah.
For, like once you encounter the first one, there's this like patina of paranoia.
Yeah.
Over the entire thing. It's great.
Also giving something really teeth that shouldn't have teeth is scary, cool, and good.
Yes. Out of these other kind of stock traps, I like a pitfall that puts me in a dangerous place.
Mm-hmm.
That will always put a big smile on my face, presuming that I cannot fall in it multiple times.
Right.
If it's the fail state for like a platforming thing, and then I'm just down in the little thing and I, go down to the timeout dungeon. That sucks. If I'm going through an area and they stick me like a level deeper
mm-hmm.
without my knowledge, that is really fun.
Yes. Yeah. At the very least, the pitfall should drain out after the fall, you know, and not before it. If you go to the difficult area and they just put you back at the beginning to try again, prison.
Yes.
That is prison.
Yeah. That's a bad, That's a Black Mirror. That's bad trap design.
Yeah.
And the reason why teleporters, I think, are irritating, you know, because they can do this as well.
Yeah.
But there's no relation between space. So like if you fall down a pitfall, I can be like, okay, I'm trying to get back up.
Yes.
If it's a teleporter, it's like, I have no idea where I'm at. I'm just in a different spot in this maze. This sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Limorex says, greetings. Just a quick Baldur's Gate 3 question for you. No spoilers. Why is the main character always thinking they're seeing blood everywhere? Is that blood? No, never mind. Or maybe they aren't seeing blood everywhere, given how much blood spatter they're covered in after fights, like they're in Bloodborne. Your thoughts? For some reason, this particular character bark, along with I've got a lot on my mind and, well, in it, seems to stand out most to me. How about you two? This happens anytime there's a character bark, I feel like.
Yes.
Where they get mimetic and repetitive because there just aren't enough of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Constantly saying stuff like that. So like these ones, I noticed them in Baldur's Gate 3, but I kind of tune them out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they don't have the enduring affection I have for like Boop Day to my journal. which I love.
Yeah, yeah. There can never be enough barks for a game, right?
Yes.
Especially, I don't know, eventually it becomes a logistical problem, you know, when you
very
have,
so.
Okay, so barks for all these situations, plus we need to do them for all seven voices that we have across an 80-hour game. You know, I think that it's just saying stuff because they feel like they need to fill space.
It's apparently, I've read like interviews with games writers, and apparently it's the hardest task.
Yes.
Like the hardest thing to do is write variations on Cheez-It, it's the spider, you know, and having them be reactive to like what's happening, you know, in the world, like coming up with, you know, put 1,000 variations of what, you know, a thug would say walking around on a patrol. Is just difficult.
Reloading. My gun's out of bullets. It's not firing anymore. What's happening?
Exactly. Cheese it. It's the bat. I'm going to get you, bat. I'm going to be the one that bags the bat. You know, that kind of thing.
I'll never be tied to a gargoyle.
Gargoyles? No way. Not for me. Webbing? What the hell? It's got a bush. that part is apparently extremely hard, and I think it makes games feel repetitive. You know, that little bit, like that's why you notice it.
Let's see. Harrison writes, howdy gang, what are your best examples of games with consequences? My wife and I just accidentally killed everyone at the Last Light Inn in Baldur's Gate. We decided to roll on and live with the fact that all our buddies are now dead and gone. I didn't even know that was possible.
Oh, it's big time possible. We're going to run into it pretty soon on the show. It's the default Dark Urge thing. It's what the Dark Urge wants, but it can just happen otherwise too. It happened on accident my first playthrough, and I actually did reload because I wanted merchants.
Yeah.
You know,
seems important.
You know, I hadn't, and it happened too early for me. I hadn't like talked to everybody.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you can trigger the thing that can make this happen on accident.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we'll talk about that in like 3 months.
Yes.
3 or 4 months on Realish Hours.
If that, they continue. What games let you fuck up, but also makes you live with those consequences in a good way that is additive?
Proud of you for rolling with that disaster.
Yeah.
That's the way to play.
Mm-hmm.
Just taking this opportunity, everybody go out and buy Alpha Protocol.
Please.
It's they got it on GOG now. It was kind of vaporware for like a long time. It was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Delisted. Now you can buy it legally and play it. It does a great job of that. Mostly through not letting you know the consequences in advance.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also a Witcher 3 thing.
Yeah.
You know, kind of famous for that. But Alpha Protocol is special in that it does it, and the consequences are not always negative. It's not always like, gotcha. Mm-hmm. You know, you thought you did a good thing, but it was a bad thing. It's more like you pissed this person off, but that actually gives you a secret advantage like 2 areas later
mm-hmm.
because it comes back to like, massage you in the ass, whatever the opposite of bite you in the ass is. You know, it comes back to eat you in the ass. put in the parlance the kids understand.
Yes. Alpha Protocol is a great example of this. It is so cool to see people gushing about Alpha Protocol on social media.
It's like one of my most popular blue skies. Uh-huh. Like I was just like, hey, buy this. It's back on. And it's like 10, reskies, 30 faves, which in the conversion rate, that's like 10 times as much in Twitter numbers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it's like a viral tweet, basically, mm-hmm. for Blue Sky. I didn't do anything. I just told people to buy a good game.
Yeah. I like the way that Morrowind handles this.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And insofar as like it will tell you like, hey, you've severed the threads of fate or whatever it is by killing this mm-hmm. person. But there's always a difficult escape valve to actually finish the game if that is what you concern yourself with. Right.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's a thing that I think games can strive towards. Mm-hmm. I like having to sit with my consequences.
Yes.
Pentiment did that well as well. Mm-hmm. The consequences were largely, narrative.
Yeah.
Like that game, the story is the story of that game in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. but little individual side character things, you would do things and be forced to make a tough decision and have it come up later.
Yeah.
That's a thing.
I also like that LA Noir. You can just fail case. Just like, hey, nope, the real person got away. Or you might never know. You might have got the wrong person later.
You can do that one.
Next one's coming up.
Yeah. One of my favorite things that games can do. Like I love that feeling. I love the confidence that ambiguity has.
Yeah. I thought about LA Noir because Pentiment is a mystery game in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Right. But it's consonant with the themes of the games because Andreas is a fuck up anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
So.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Levine says, I recently watched Tim Rogers' translation series on Final Fantasy VII, and it got me thinking about how meaning can be lost or distorted in the process. As some of your guys' favorite games are from non-English developers, from Larian, etc., do you ever wonder if you are getting the real experience playing those games in English? Have you ever considered learning a new language to better experience a game you loved? I've never done the latter. Learning a language is really hard.
Yeah.
That's too much work for me.
Mr. I downloaded Duolingo to learn Portuguese.
That was for Fuppets.
Because Fuppets.
Yeah, that's not a video game.
That's a higher.
Put some respect on fucking tiny Fuppets. It's not a video game. Put some respect on the Fuppets' mouth. I also gave up on that like twice.
Yes.
I've done the, and then it got hard, and then I was like, well, it was fun. Like, I'm not proud of the fact that I gave up on it. It's just, it got hard.
Yeah.
And I was doing it a lot on the bus, and it kept wanting me to talk into my phone.
Oh, yeah.
On the bus, which I didn't want to do. Like, it's just like, this sucks.
I'm not going to mutter in Portuguese in public.
I don't need to be that bus guy.
Yeah.
This is a thing that I think, I'm always like really interested in this because I think that what this will do is a kind of Chekhov's like game thing mm-hmm. that will frustrate me a little bit where, I think some critics and some fans cannot allow a second level language game to have bad writing. Mm-hmm. Like, if it's bad, that has to be the translation. If it's good, it's because of the actual writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really frustrating. Like, we ran into this when we were doing research for Castlevania 2.
Yes.
Right? And that's a game where it misleads you and lies to you all the time, has a lot of awkward text that is obfuscates the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And forever, like my entire life, the popular conception was like, oh, man, in the actual original language, this is brilliant and direct. Mm-hmm. And helpful. It's just us shitty Americans who got the crappy translated version.
Yeah.
And that's just not the case. Like if you look into it at all, that's not what happened. And they sell these games here. Mm-hmm. It's a major market. They want them translated here.
Yeah.
Well, like there are limitations to that. There are games where I think that they probably do come across better.
Yeah.
With translation. I hate it as a be all end all solution and answer to anything.
Yeah.
Which I think happens a lot.
I don't sweat this at all, really. Like it is interesting to me. Like those Legends of Localization books are good. I enjoy understanding the process, but localization is done with intent by also creative people mm-hmm. who are doing their best to reinterpret the original intent. And I just have to trust that, because otherwise, like you said, it is this shifting sands of culpability.
Modern days, like, it's done in house by real serious people.
Yes.
You know, like, I'm Larian, you know, something like the games Larian makes are not made and then translated.
Yeah.
You know, and if you look at modern Dark Souls games, like, the voiceover is in English.
Yeah.
You know, just the world round.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're made to be both of the languages at once. So every once in a while you'll run into, like, oh, if you look at this translation, this person's called the captain, but a more accurate translation of that word would be the Lord. And that has this lore implication.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those have not added up to anything.
Yeah.
When I've read about them, like, there's a cottage industry of pointing those out, and I'm glad those people have jobs.
Yes.
But I don't sweat it. Like, mm-hmm. I'm with you in that. Like, it's just like, yeah. No, like, you know, we got what we got is more fun to interpret it like this. And a lot of times those turn out to be a little bit kind of nothings.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of smoke.
This intersects with Hellworld. Quite a bit is the thing, because there are a lot of people who clamor, no, we need the literal translation. Otherwise it's going to be made woke.
Yes.
You know, which I believe is supremely irritating for a number of very obvious reasons, but also is missing the point of translation versus interpretation, localization, yeah. Right? Which is a really basic, like, 101 level distinction that you need to be able to draw.
And then also just realizing again, like, we are not a secondary market,
yeah,
for these things. So, like, if a game company removes a vagina bone and puts it, like, I've been checked out of this discourse, so my references for it are old. But, like, if a game company, you know, censors a game, like, makes somebody's titties not hanging out,
mm-hmm.
That's not the localizers. That's the company saying this might sell better in America if it's not gross.
Yeah.
Because they want to make money.
Right.
Like, there's nothing woke about it. They think that it will do better for them.
Yeah.
Like, they are a business at the end of the day. All they care about is money.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So yeah, it's not, it's so misguided on multiple levels. Like, it's the free market. You idiots love that.
Yep. Please, you know? Please blame the right thing if you're going to get mad.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, I would prefer that you have some perspective, but if you are going to be mad, diagnose the problem correctly, please.
Yeah. If you're going to die angry, you don't want to die angry about something that doesn't matter.
Don't die angry and wrong.
Yeah, exactly. At least die angry and right. That makes you a cool martyr. Dying angry and wrong just makes you an idiot, and people do it all the time.
Oh, Mike writes, I was curious if you guys experience any big game anxiety. I find that I love big RPGs and have completed many, but anytime I want to start a new big game, I feel anxiety. Like, will I miss content? Will I make a good enough build? Basically, what if I do it wrong? Currently playing through Divinity Original Sin 2, and I'm loving it, but I can't shake that feeling. Wondering if you feel this way, if you feel this way ever, and how you overcame it if you had.
I like big game anxiety, like when we're hunting rhinos. Like, my anxiety is that I'm going to get gored.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, this doesn't hit me when I am in the middle of a big game. It's more just something that will stop me from even starting one.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think I all have that too, but it's not like I feel like I'm going to do something wrong.
Yeah.
Miss content or not make a good enough build. It's more just that's a whole lot of something in front of me.
Yeah.
Like, the process of putting it behind me is going to take a lot of time.
Yeah.
You know, and that kind of intimidation will happen. It's not necessarily about choices in the game for me.
Yeah. It's you know, the waiter sitting down in front of you, a steak that's the size of a boogie board. And when you think you're done, they say, he's not done yet.
You're not done.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I will often have that. And the way I get past it, a lot of times I don't, because I, you know, I play things for work and do other stuff. But when I do get past it, you just plunge in.
Yeah.
A cool thing, you know, thinking about Divinity Original Sin 2, thinking about a lot of these games now, is they have respec options, typically for free or practically for free.
Yeah.
So the build anxiety, like, you can put that away, you know, in Divinity Original Sin 2, you're going to get access to a mirror that'll let you just respec whenever you want.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about that stuff. Try stuff.
That combined with point of no return warnings does a lot to alleviate this. And I get over the big game anxiety also by by varying up the length of things that I play, you know, like
when
I finish Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, which I'm greatly enjoying, I'm probably not going to jump directly into Dragon's Dogma 2, which I also want to try. Maybe I'm going to, you know, knock a couple of quickies off before I move on to something else that's huge.
Autumn says, I enjoyed Unavowed a lot, but I guess as adventure games go, it's not very rigorous. I love some recommendations that can ease me into more complex staples of the genre. Also, Gary, have you ever thought about making a magic cube? It's incredible. It's like fussing over the minutiae of 10 decks at once, and you only get to play it a tenth as often. I have thought about that. I have not. My Brayton and Riff, who I have played Magic with in the past, we're all just adults, so we don't get together very often. Like, we haven't had time outside of our weekly game night. So Magic has been on the back burner for me. But I do have a bunch of cards, and I've thought about doing it.
Have you ever thought about making a magic cube?
Cube. Good sentence.
Yep.
Like, have you ever pondered creating the Mystic Orb? In terms of adventure games are a little bit more rigorous, even though it is in conversation with previous games in a way that will make the ending of it especially weird, I really like Thimbleweed Park as a game with puzzles that handles hints really well.
Okay. I was thinking about suggesting that because it's really good. I also wonder if the fact that so many of the puzzles span so many environments would be very off-putting to someone who was coming from something mechanics light, like Unavowed.
It's hard to think of a middle step.
It is.
You know, the reason why I thought of Thimbleweed is because it has that really perfect hint system.
Yeah.
You know, like diegetic hint system through the phone book and the phone, where you can get really, really meaningful hints that don't give the game away in game.
Yes.
The other way to do this, I think, would be to play any classic adventure game that has puzzles and just have access to Universal Hint System.
Yeah.
Which has an entry for most classic adventure games and does a really good job of graduated, like, stepped hints.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to come up with an answer for this question, especially because I am not very conversant in a lot of recent adventure games, you know, where strides in accessibility have been made, you know? All I can fall back on is Day of the Tentacle isn't very rigorous, right?
Yeah, it's hard because, like, modern adventure games, Wajid Eye is a big name in the modern adventure game factory, and they are mechanically very light.
Yeah.
Like, generally, they are not as concerned with puzzles as they are with other things. And that goes for all the ones I've played. You know, that company, like, I like them, but that's just not what they're there for.
Yeah.
You know,
What might hit the sweet spot of complexity for this is Strangeland. I know that the writing in that is not very good, but, like, the level of puzzle, that's not made by Wajid Eye, but it's published by Wajid Eye, you know, of things that are in that milieu, it might actually be a pretty good fit as a step up.
It might bridge the gap.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more complicated than Unavowed.
Yeah.
For that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jordan or Maya writes, do you prefer RPGs with fiction forward mechanics that eschew complexity but allow a wider range of player expression, or games that are crunchy and heavily mechanical but do not offer much in the realm of role playability?
It's hard not to think of this in terms of tabletop because of those terms.
Yeah.
You know, like, in video games, por qué no los dos? You know, like, all my favorite games do both of these things.
Yes.
Like, you don't need to eschew complexity in order to have strong fiction.
Mm-hmm.
In games, you know, can look at, like, you know, Baldur's Gate 3 is obviously a perennial example, but this happens with, you know, like, your Witcher's 3. This happens in a little bit to Disco Elysium, which is not mechanically, like, complicated in terms of having battle mechanics, but is actually kind of surprisingly complicated mechanically in its dice mechanics. You know, when I think of something that is fiction forward and eschewing complexity, I think of, like, The Walking Dead or something, you know, or The Quarry, something like that. Like, that does not have very much. And I don't think of it necessarily as an either or prospect.
If this is a would you rather kind of thing, you know, so, you know, somebody snaps their fingers and suddenly you are in a world with only games that are story forward and offer a lot of variability with role playing, or only games that are heavily mechanical, but the story is not much of a factor. I would probably go with the latter because I can still get stories in other places.
Same. Like I would just read more books.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty rare for me. People say this a lot, but for me at least, it is pretty rare that I play a very, very story focused video game and I'm like, this is the best way to have told that story.
Yeah.
You know, like even if it is a great story, I think a lot of times if it is very mechanics backward or backseated, it's not really taking advantage of the medium as much as I want it to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm really like, just, oh, this is awesome. This could only be told as a video game. And this is as good as any book or movie. Like, that's very rare for me, purely from a narrative standpoint.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Should we move on to other question types?
We should. We got a couple of life questions here. Why don't you tell me
what Harrison
says asks. Here.
What would a burger, Gary's or Cole's Way entail? Do you have strong opinions on types of French fries? That is all. Perfect burger, Cole, go.
Perfect burger. Okay. A burger, that has some crispy edges on it. I like, I like a little bit.
Like a smash burger?
Yeah. Let's say that, on it would be, pepper jack, cooked onions and barbecue sauce. For the bun, I would say just like a toasted regular bun on that.
Okay. Rodeo. Like going for a rodeo.
Yes.
Is what I call that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna go for mine, pretzel bun.
Okay.
Double smash burger.
Okay.
Melted cheddar cheese, grilled onions, peppers, mushrooms, and then a sauce, like a mayonnaise based special sauce as its thing.
Yes.
So,
for fries, as long as they are not crinkle cut or unseasoned curly, we can talk.
Okay.
I do not enjoy a crinkle cut fry at all. They are, I think, the easiest to fuck up in terms of like really good fries. I would say, gotta go with the hand cut, you know, just
hand cuts are best.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think steak fries are the weakest fry.
Okay.
Like I've had a bunch of steak fries that are just like super bland.
Yeah. They're down there.
Yeah. They're seasoned curly fry. I like quite a bit.
Yes.
Hand cut, obviously superior.
Yeah.
The superior fry.
Hand cut takes vinegar. That is always very tasty.
Yeah. I also like sweet potato fries personally.
Chapel writes, with Easter coming up, a church near my house has updated their signage. It now says the tomb is empty. He is risen.
Oh, shit. Run.
I'm a good Christian boy, but that's one of the scariest fucking things I've ever read. What are some of the most ominous bits of signage you guys have ever seen? That reminds me of my favorite, a joke that I like that my brother Chris has made very frequently. Mm-hmm. I have no idea if it's an original of his, but he says, Jesus is coming. Get a towel.
No, very good.
Yeah.
The, I don't have an ominous sign I can think of, but I do have, when I first moved out here, I think I've talked about this before. I used to live by a mechanic, called the Master Wrench. Which is great. Great name for a mechanic already. You know, I imagine like, you know, it's stuck in a stone and stuff, but instead of putting on their side of their things, they didn't have like specials and stuff. They just had wisdom on there. So you would like drive by it or walk by it and it would just have the master wrench, huge billboard that just says never rationalize anything that feels wrong. And I'd be like, thanks mechanic.
Yeah.
Like shit, I guess I won't. you know, it wasn't necessarily ominous, but it was definitely a big mood shift kind of thing.
Yeah. The building next to the dentist that I've gone to since I was a very young child out in Lexington, Ohio. The building next to it is one of those drive-through convenience stores that we have.
Okay.
You know, and the sign out front was never used to advertise like specials, you know, like deals on cigarettes or whatever. It was specifically used by the owner of the place to complain about his bitch of an ex-wife. Is how that person would have said it.
Straight up Mayor Tim, or District Attorney of San Bernardino, Tim Heidecker behavior.
Yep. It was just every time you passed by, there was some new grievance. Occasionally there were pot shots about, like, you know, happen to hear people speak Spanish or whatever. But like, all you could do when you looked at that was like, think, I don't think that the law should be against this, but I think that this person should be discouraged from that. And I also,
there should be something.
Yeah. There should be some social sanction. Yeah.
Yeah. Like they should dispatch the junior minis of laws. Like, it's not against the law, but you're on thin ice. Like, yeah, you at least get a disc.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also, you know, that poor woman, right?
Yeah, that fucking sucks.
Yep.
Yeah, we're laughing at it, but it also sucks.
It also is bad.
Yeah, yeah. It's just petty as hell. Mm-hmm. You know. Steven says, "Did you ever have New Coke? What was it like compared to regular Coke? It was gone by the time I learned about it, and I've always been curious. Sweeter and more like Pepsi.
Mm-hmm.
If you like the kind of stinging bite of Coke, which I do. Like, if I'm going to drink a cola, that's mm-hmm. the one I'm going to drink, even though I don't drink soda. But if I were going to, I like that kind of bitter thing. That is old Coke. New Coke was made because they did a bunch of blind taste tests,
mm-hmm.
and people actually did prefer the taste of Pepsi. That was a huge advertising campaign in the 80s. So they came up with New Coke to make it more like Pepsi. A little bit less carbonated, a little sweeter.
Yeah. Yep. Was too young. I believe the New Coke was discontinued by the time I was of soda drinking age. My understanding is that New Coke, like, that eventually worked its way around to become Diet Coke in some form or fashion as well.
I don't think so. Because that's what Tab turned into.
Yeah.
And, turned into Diet Coke. And Diet Coke might have that kind of similar sweetness.
Yeah.
Kind of profile, but it's the New Coke was definitely a full sugar Coke.
Yeah.
It was, yeah.
Huh. Yeah. I will accept being wrong about that.
Yeah. It's also mostly before my time as well.
Yeah.
I just had a novelty soda obsession.
Mm-hmm.
Even as a teen. So, yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Moving now to media questions. Mm-hmm. Douglas asks, a lot of the questions that we've done this time are old, by the way.
Yes.
So do not feel left out if you asked a question this month and we don't get to it.
It up for some back questions.
Yeah. Douglas writes, "Recently I rewatched The Soul's Inheritors essay by Noah Caldwell Gervais, and I was struck by his assertion that Sekiro was actually the best Soulsborne game. Also recently, Gary, you put forth an opinion about the TV show 30 Rock that I shall not repeat. My questions are, have either of you ever spit-taked so hard at the opinion of a critic whom you respect that it made you question everything they've done? Second, has the opinion of another critic or friend on a game ever changed the way you think about it? As if seeing that other perspective opened something in your mind and made you think differently. I ask these because I was disgusted at Sekiro in 2019, and after watching Caldwell Gervais' video again, I went back to it and I'm loving it. His take totally changed my mindset on the game, and I'm close to platinuming now. On 30 Rock, well, Gary and I are just very different people."
I don't think I've ever said anything that strong about 30 Rock. Like, in terms of the big NBC sitcoms, it's my least favorite of mm-hmm. them, but I watched like the first like four or five seasons.
Yeah.
It got a little up its ass with guest stars and I stopped watching it.
Yeah.
And I still liked it and enjoyed it. It was just, I don't have a very strong opinion on 30 Rock.
Yeah. Yeah.
I am surprised. I would be curious as to what this is from.
I think it is literally you putting 30 Rock behind The Office and Parks and Rec in a recent-ish dispatch, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would put it behind those two.
Yeah.
But it's not like I don't put it with Young Sheldon. Like it's not Big Bang Theory or anything to me. I still watched it.
Right.
So typically this idea of like a critic liking something in a way that I don't. Mm-hmm. It happens to me with, you know, with some frequency. It's happened to me with Noah. Mm-hmm. Like early Noah, you know, one of the first things I watched by him was his BioShock Infinite video, which I'd be curious if he stands by it now. Mm-hmm. He's pretty glowing about it. But this even happens with like modern critics who I like, who mm-hmm. I respect a lot. Like roughly, and I love this man. I think he's a national treasure, but like roughly 1/4 of the things that I read from Austin Walker, I disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, respectfully disagree with, but disagree with. Like, I just don't see the same thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't make me question everything they've ever done. I'm just like, oh, this is ineffables.
Yeah.
Like, this is a thing where this just worked in a way, you know, the saving throw thing. Mm-hmm. Like, they made a saving throw I didn't, or vice versa.
Yes.
You know, and there was a level of buy-in from the beginning of this that I didn't have, or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
That'll happen with this.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it happens a lot. It doesn't usually make me go back. What will happen if somebody says something is, if a critic is like, this thing that I think is really special, if they're like, it's bad,
mm-hmm.
I do have like an instant want to know what they think is good.
Yeah.
Like if I see somebody complain about like the writing in Baldur's Gate 3, which is like not perfect, mm-hmm. I want to know what they consider to be good writing.
Yes.
Like, you know, I want to have like a measurement mm-hmm. of it.
I want more specificity as well.
Yes, yeah. Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the second one, you know, a critic or friend changed the way I think about something. That happens all the time on this show. Right. Yeah. So
it never makes me go all the way back.
Right.
Something.
Yeah.
Right. So like if me and Cole played something and we talk about it and you make, a good argument for a framing of it,
mm-hmm.
I like understanding a way one could like it
mm-hmm.
more, but it doesn't change how it lived in my hands.
Yeah.
Usually, you know, so I'm never like going back and being like, oh, like this, I like this now. That doesn't usually happen.
Yeah.
When I first play something, I tend to be, not everybody believes this probably, but I'm very intentional about like, and careful about how I feel about something. It's not just like, this sucks. It's down.
Dump it.
I do give things chances and stuff. I'm not just dump it.
Yeah.
You know, so like when I come to the show, it's not an ill-considered opinion.
Yeah.
It's not like the first impression and I just ran with it.
Yeah.
You know, I do try to look through lenses to like a thing.
Mm-hmm.
What I come to with the show is where I landed after doing that.
Yeah. When I say it happens all the time on the show, I don't mean like, you know, total 180s, because our job isn't really to persuade each other to think like we do, but more through the act of disagreeing, I gain a better understanding of why I like something or why I don't, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Same.
Yeah. That is changing. That is a different perspective, changing the way that I think, but not the overall like modality of my opinion, let's say.
Yes. Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
You know, like it can help calcify or clarify a thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, like it's interesting that, Noah Gervais thing, like the Sekiro one where him talking about it, all the things I think he said about it were true.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, but they were just, I was like, oh, like those things are true. I just don't care about those things.
Yeah.
You know, and that was basically how I felt about it before. It kind of like strengthened that mm-hmm. feeling in me.
Yeah.
You know, like he's making a steel man, mm-hmm. like an absolute steel man for this thing.
Yes.
It's just a man who I'm not interested in, you know?
Yeah. Good question.
Yeah. Good question. Austin says, media question. I recently went down a disturbing music rabbit hole and discovered Current 93's I Have a Special Plan for the World, which is a musical adaptation of Thomas Ligotti's poem by the same name. Thomas Ligotti actually wrote it in collaboration with the band. He provided the words, they provided the sound. I absolutely loved it. Have either of you listened to it? I know Cole has read one of Thomas Ligotti's work as one of the yearly Halloween readings. What is your take on music and as Eldritch media? I think it's a woefully untapped possibility space. Thank you for everything you do. You're welcome.
Yeah. I have read that. I did read that Prodigy of Dreams short story from Thomas Ligotti. Did that. Have not read a lot of him in general. It's one of those things where I have some like books on a wish list on Kindle or whatever, but I don't know. I've just never gotten around to it. I generally like, you know, cosmic horror things that are attributed to Thomas Ligotti because of the extreme pessimism, you know, to it. It is a bit of a different take from like a, you know, the generally like mythology focused stuff that like a Derleth would do. Right.
Yeah.
But like any of his kind of longer form works and stuff like The Conspiracy Against the Human Race, like that to me seems like it would be very tiring, you know, because of that same pessimism kind of deal. So my experience is minimal and kind of based on a lot of I'm going to call it prejudice because I am prejudging something based on what I know about his general posture. Oh, yeah. Based on what I know about his posture.
Yeah. And the posture of other people with his skin color. I understand.
Jesus.
I know what you mean. I'm just teasing you. I'm generally warm towards the idea of Thomas Ligotti, but have not read very much. Mm-hmm. Just some stuff in compilations. Musical adaptations of stuff like that tend to be more metal than I like. Mm-hmm. A lot of bands that are Lovecraftian in nature specifically tend to be metal bands.
Yeah.
And I just don't care for metal. Yes. Like, you know, it's just at the end of the day.
I can picture like in my head, like a platonic ideal of something that captures the psychedelia of what I mm-hmm. want. You know, similar to like, you know, those kind of dreamish sequences from Neonomicon. I can picture that. Yes. With all the fractals and stuff, but the reality of that kind of music is a little bit more like the band in Neonomicon.
Yes. And, you know, and that's really well observed in Neonomicon.
Yes.
Like as a thing, like that is like what a lot of the fandom is. And then like, it goes to big bands too. Like Metallica has 10 Lovecraft songs, you know, and everything. And I'm just like, you know, music is such an arbitrary, subjective thing, more subjective than almost anything.
Yeah.
I feel like everything is subjective, but like something can either just sound good or sound bad to you.
Yeah.
And when something pops up and it's super metal-y, it just sounds bad to me. Mm-hmm. No judgment. I just don't, it's just not for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We should move on to show questions before hitting. Yeah. So let's see here. Eli writes, "Hey guys, I love Unfilmable. Always a highlight of my month. A question for Cole here. Cole, when will you buck up and bring a David Lynch movie to the podcast to make Gary watch? It was fun watching him bring Silent Night, Deadly Night 5, and The Video Dead while you kept bringing conventionally beloved horror movies. But the Garbage Pail Kids movie? He clearly won't stop making you watch actually bad movies. So what are you waiting for?"
I referenced this in Guppy because I was like, Cole and I aren't fighting on Unfilmable.
No.
You know, like me and you are, Will. And then Eli reached out to me on Blue Sky and was like, I was the person who asked that question. And here we are, full circle.
Yeah.
I'd like to point out a little Cole pick for Unfilmable called American Movie, which is possibly the biggest stretch that we've done on the show.
Uh-huh.
So I don't need these wild accusations. Silent Night, Deadly Night 5 is a horror movie. The Video Dead is a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
Garbage Pail Kids was a stretch, but I don't feel like it's as, like that much bigger of a stretch, if bigger of a stretch, than American Movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd like to, you know, just come on, 1-800, come on now.
Although come on now. American Movie is a good movie.
I love American Movie, but the point of the show, it's not called The Good Movie Show. You know, it's horror movies. We look at horror media. It's not like we look at good horror media.
I will say you agreed to watch it. So yeah, there is also that.
You agreed
that.
To watch those too.
Like, I did. Yeah.
I'm putting the system. I'm putting the question on trial.
Yeah. But you notice there are three examples here to one of mine.
But two of my examples are perfectly cromulent. The Video Dead and Silent Night, Deadly Night 5 are both just traditional horror movies. Only one of these is a stretch.
Yeah, yeah.
Chernobyl is a stretch.
There we go.
I did Chernobyl. There's my other stretch.
Yeah.
On there.
Yes. So that's four to my one. Okay.
Yeah.
What Eli's talking about is like the quality of movie or whatever, to which I would say, you know, I celebrate the entire gamut of quality in horror movies. You know, I think we both do.
Yeah.
You know, because even the worst executed movie can still have really fun ideas, and at the very worst can have fun things to make fun of.
Yeah. Like you brought Saw.
Yes.
As a thing. I don't dislike Saw, mm-hmm. but I don't think Saw is necessarily a good movie. You know, and it's funny.
Yes.
You know, there are cool parts of it. There are also parts of it that are just funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the point of the show is not to watch good movies. That said, like if you want to do Blue Velvet, let's do Blue Velvet.
Mm-hmm.
Like I like Blue Velvet a lot.
Yeah.
Like I'm not anti Lynch.
Yeah.
I'm just not as big a fan.
We had a little bit, Eli had no reason to have heard this unless they were in the room when we recorded it.
Oh, God.
Eli, I think Eli is in Ohio, if it's the same person. So could have happened, but, like we had a little bit of this conversation in Skinamarink. I had no idea that Skinamarink was the slow horror, you know, like the slow cinema, version mm-hmm. of that. And if I knew that that was the kind of bullet I was going to be firing, I would have subbed in another movie that I like better, you know, out of
that is
out
also of Lynch. Slow cinema.
That is also slow. So like Skinamarink kind of delays that because we like to you know bring in some variety, and also it's been a certain amount of just indecision because when I think about horror-y David Lynch movies, I kind of feel like any of them would work. Like I would love to talk about Fire Walk With Me. I would love to talk about, you know, Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive, Blue Velvet, any of those. I don't know which one to do first would be the thing.
Do Blue Velvet first. Just because I already like it the most.
Yeah. Okay.
It'll be the most fun for Gary. It's my favorite of the David Lynch movies.
Oh, yeah.
And you like it as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not maybe not your favorite, but you like it a lot. I think we'll get the most general likitude
mm-hmm.
from that intersection. Yeah. But I just, you know, I'm bagging on Eli a little bit. The actual answer is the point of the show is not necessarily to do good movies.
Mm-hmm.
The point of the show is to have a fun episode and have like fun things to talk about and be exposed to these things. Some of my favorite episodes of that show have been, you know, crappy movies.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really delicious feeling like Silent Night, Deadly Night 5 is not a good movie,
mm-hmm.
but like you watch the scene where they sell that horrible little worm thing in the store and it just raises a lot of questions. And for me, and I hope this is true, you know, I'm not dancing alone here. Like when I watch that, I'm like, oh, this is going to be fun to talk about with Cole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not just like, hey, take that Cole. You watch some real dog shit.
No.
We're going to make fun of this and it's going to be fun because we're going to goof around.
Yeah.
Like that's super valuable to me. And
yes.
if you know, if it's not what people are, if somebody doesn't enjoy that while listening to the show, that's also okay.
Yeah.
You know, we got to make the show that we like doing.
It's also imperative, I think, that we acknowledge Eli's joking.
Yes.
You know, to a degree.
I think Eli's being
Eli's been a fan long enough that they understand they understand everything that we just said. I don't think it's an actual grievance that they have about the show.
No. Speaking kind of generally,
yes,
you know, for fandom and for bits of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We do get a lot of bad movies through like Adaptation Decay as well.
Yes. Yeah.
So the movies tend to be pretty special mm-hmm. if they show up on that.
Yeah.
Malachi says, this will be our last one. We'll go into lightning round. A couple of podcast questions. How far ahead is the schedule planned? I know you have called a few audibles in the history of the network due to bouncing off a game or other complications, but as a general rule, how far ahead is set in stone? And two, if you could magically get any guest you wanted, alive or dead, for an episode of any Duckfeed show, past or present, what would it be?
Yeah. So for the first one, the farthest ahead that we plan is WAF. Mm-hmm. And the schedule is pretty sketched out because we get the patron demands and we that tends to establish some spacing and also like the kind of the slots that we need to fill.
Between that and us, now that we've been ping ponging months,
yes,
you know what we call vanity picks—the vanity of choosing a game to cover on your podcast. You know that ultimate hubris.
Yeah.
You know, since we have vanity picks now, that is a thing that it's easier to pick these.
Yes,
like it's much easier to kind of go through them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so about 2 months in advance, right? Yes. I realize we have a spot in May that we haven't looked at. Both of us opened that spreadsheet right away.
Hell yeah. Yeah, classic. Yeah. It's okay, that's what markers are for.
That's what markers are for, yeah. Generally, you know, the WAF schedule is set in stone 2 months in advance, right?
It's set in stone 2 months in advance, but we also know some of what we're doing for the whole year because of patron picks.
Yes.
And when we wrap up winter RPG, there tends to be something that we wanted to do as well.
Yes.
That will pop up. So like we basically, it's not absolutely in stone, but we know what we're doing in December.
Yeah.
Like we're leaning towards a thing we want to play, you know? So pretty far in advance.
Yes.
For these things, but it's the only show that gets that treatment.
Yeah.
Basically.
You know, Unfilmable, like any of the movie shows, we pretty much Unfilmable, we decide, when we are recording the episode. Yeah.
Like whoever's turned it is brings a pick or two.
Yes. Yeah. Adaptation Decay, we decide a couple of weeks ahead of time. And then Abject Suffering is literally, you know, just, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of it's random as well.
Yes.
So yeah, generally pretty far in advance for the flagship show.
Yes. For the magically get any guest that I wanted alive or dead, that is a pretty big question. I'm just going to cop out and say if magic is in play and I suddenly understand Japanese, I don't know. It'd be pretty cool to talk to Miyazaki. He seems pretty open. So, yeah.
I'm going to say my mom for an episode of Duck Feed Presents that we never publish.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Just, some lingering questions. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it would be cool to talk to Miyazaki. I think that I would be very intimidated by that. And yes. I would want to ask questions that he hasn't been asked a lot. Like he is a well-interviewed man, you know, so that makes that a little bit tricky.
Yeah.
And I also like having guests on the show from a, it generates heat.
Yes.
Perspective. The actual process of it is like having a lightning rod up my ass for like the entire interview. A lot of the times, like I get nervous.
Yes.
About it. And feel like really anxious and kind of flinch after everything I say.
Oh, so super self-conscious. Yeah.
Yes. So if it were somebody like very famous, especially somebody who is very famous, who came back from the dead just for this, I can only imagine that feeling being like amplified.
If I dragged them from their eternal reward.
Yes. You know, the Speak with Dead that we do on Abraham Lincoln to find out what he thinks about Mega Man Legends 4, like, you know, whatever. Like, I can't imagine it.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be funny. If I were a sociopath, it'd be great. Like it would just be like, yeah, John Wilkes Booth, Guppy, go, you know, and it would be incredible. Like,
yeah. You
know, hey man, like, did you get to catch any of the play? Was it cool? You know,
I want an actor's perspective on our American cousin.
Yeah. Like, you know, like, I don't know. There are a lot of fun answers for that, but I can't interface with people that way.
Yeah. I would want to talk with people who seem cool. So like, it'd be fun to have Jay Tholen on or something, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's very accomplishable too.
Oh, absolutely.
I feel like we could just ask Jay.
Yeah.
I would love to podcast with golden era Sean Elliott.
Oh yeah.
Who I think is smart and shares a little bit of my sense of humor. I think we could get along okay. Mm-hmm. But I say that and then who knows?
Yeah.
You know, maybe it would just be awkward and I would also still be me.
Yeah.
You know. So
lightning round, baby.
Lightning round.
Yeah, let me scroll up to that. We have Matthew who writes, would you still podcast if you were a worm? And also, what kind of worm would you be?
If I was a talking worm, I might try.
Yeah.
I'd have to be able to talk.
Mm-hmm. That would be the main concern. What kind of worm would I be? Inchworm? Yeah. Inchworm, because I like the way they move. That's real cool.
Yeah, even though it might be nauseating. I thought about the inchworm movement and like getting sick during it, just the shunt forward, you know?
Yeah. But I figure, you know, you get nauseated because the way your equipment is calibrated. If I became a worm, I would assume that I wouldn't have like cochlear disorders.
Have all the powers of a worm.
Yeah. I would have all the powers of the worm. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know which kind of worm I'd be. I'd have to do some worm research because there are probably some cool ass worms out there.
Yeah.
You know, one of those worms that can be cut in half and just become two worms. That's pretty sick.
Yeah, it's just an earthworm.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, Eric says, what's your guys' take on the Magic the Gathering Universes Beyond products? Do you plan to buy any of the Fallout cards? I feel like they've been pushing out so much content, it's hard to keep up and prices keep going up. However, I love the Lord of the Rings collection and I'm currently working on a Tom Bombadil Commander deck. Cole, are you going to buy Universes Beyond?
No.
Yeah,
no.
You going to start?
It seemed like the whole practice seems a little bit sweaty to me, but I don't play the game. So I have literally zero stakes. So
I get, like, my initial impression was like, this is sweaty beyond measure. Mm-hmm. And then, but they're actually, it feels like there's care taken in them.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't picked up them, but they are adapting. Like, as a fan of adaptation, I like seeing how, like, a aspect of a piece of fiction can be translated into a mechanic in an existing game. So I follow these, like, I look at them, and they don't seem phoned in to me. I haven't really been getting them. The Fallout ones I might, because there's a Frank Horrigan card.
Oh, shit.
They put in, like, a Fallout 2
thing,
and I'm like, that's not something I ever thought I would, you know, would exist. So I might try to find that.
Yeah.
But I haven't really been keeping up with them.
Dylan writes, a phrase of y'all's that has entered my vocabulary is fucked up little dudes. Who are your favorite fucked up little dudes in games? What makes a good fucked up little dude?
My favorite fucked up little dudes in games.
Yeah. I mean, are we ruling out Albinoryx? Because I feel like Albinoryx are pretty high up there.
Albinoryx are really high up there. I don't think we're ruling out Albinoryx. I think we are ruling out, like, serve bots. Like, cute,
they're not
cute
fucked
little
up.
Dudes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not fucked up. Like, it, we're ruling out Baboms.
Yeah.
You know, like, we're like toads. You know, they got to be more fucked up.
Yeah. A Monty Mole, I think, counts as fucked up.
Monty Mole is pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
That guy's twisted. that guy's fucking sick. That guy's a joker. That guy's not going to live very long. He doesn't care.
I might just have to say Albinoryx. There are plenty of good fucked up little dudes in Baldur's Gate 3, but it is hard for me to immediately put a finger on one.
Lots of souls enemies, little baby skeletons from Dark Souls 1.
Yeah,
great fucked up little dudes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wheel skeletons initially. Like, they're not as little as maybe I want them to be, but they are a little bit little, you know, compared to me, a human who's bigger than my monitor.
Yeah.
The
amount of dignity that a fucked up little dude is allowed to have, I feel, is a difficult calibration.
Yeah. I think it's not very much.
Yeah.
I think they can't be too dignified.
They can't. No.
You know, like, it's kind of difficult. Is a Tonberry a fucked up little dude? That guy seems like he has his life in order. I don't think there's anything fucked up about him.
When I think about somebody fucked up, I think about somebody in a hurry.
Yes.
And a Tonberry has a plan.
Yep. Tonberry is going to work.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing fucked up about him. No. Morgan says, hi. I really enjoyed your unfilmable episode on Neonomicon. It got me wondering if you consider discussing a podcast or other media formats for the show. On that note, have either of you listened to the Lovecraft Investigations? It's a really fun, creepy narrative podcast, BBC radio drama that uses Lovecraft's story and mythos as frames for contemporary folk horror. I reckon you both enjoy it. Message ends. I would consider doing any of that stuff, time allowed. I don't see any reason why not. Someday we just, you know, no new shows until current shows are dealt with there. And I have not listened to that. I have listened to a bunch of the Dark Adventure Radio Theater, which is the Lovecraft Historical Society's radio dramatizations, both live and recorded.
Yeah.
Cannot recommend those enough. Those are really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like as a, they're up there with the HP Podcraft as the best way to take in those stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having them summarize them is really good because they're funny and they bear summary better than they do reading sometimes. But the actual radio play versions of them, you get the whole story, but they're kind of like fixed for pacing.
Yeah.
You know, like it's still, you still get the prose, but they make really clever changes to make the stories work.
Yeah.
And it can make incredibly mid prose stories like really pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Rats in the Walls, real good. As the Dark Adventure Radio Theater.
Mm-hmm.
That is the closest thing I've done to that.
Yeah. I'm all for stretching the format of Unfilmable, you know.
Yeah.
If I found a podcast that I liked, that felt like it would bear not criticism, but would bear analysis. Yeah, sure. That's just not the kind of podcast that I listen to. I don't listen to fiction podcasts. It's just, I'm not above it. It's just not something I'm naturally inclined to.
It's like webcomics. Yeah. Like it has a place in your life where it doesn't.
Yeah.
you know, or like podcasts in general, but like it reminds me a lot of webcomics. Like I know people who just wake up every day and they read their webcomics. If you know, I understand people who just like follow a narrative in a podcast,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just, you either do or you don't.
Yes. Naveen writes, what's your peak video game character blunt rotation?
No, I have no answer for that because smoking things hurts me.
Yeah.
cannot smoke a blunt. Shan't smoke a blunt.
Yeah.
My lungs don't want things that aren't air.
Assume that you did.
Like a gummy rotation.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of a gummy rotation. In that case, we're all going to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So my ideal gummy rotation is Kirby and Jigglypuff and Snorlax, and I sleep in a big pile between the three of them, and it's great.
Yeah. It's harder to think of peak video game character blunt rotation than it is to think of nightmare video game blunt rotation.
Oh, yeah.
So like,
fucking the G-Man,
the G-Man, JC Denton and Psyduck
would be
really bad. That would be fucking terrible.
I would just getting chiefed with JC Denton would be okay.
Oh, that'd be, man, that would be so, like, he's so tedious, dude.
But he would loosen up.
Oh no.
You think the devil's lettuce would loosen up?
No, I think it would make him more like that.
He might become more paranoid. He already believes in a lot of conspiracies.
Yeah.
Because they're true. Like there'd be a lot of conspiracies, and like you'd hear MJ12 way more than you want to.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So sorry I didn't answer the question as asked, but nightmare blunt rotation. That one's easy. Yeah.
Michelle says, the good news is that you haven't been cursed by a genie for this question. The bad news is you just lost a bet and are now legally bound to speedrun a game of your choosing for 1 year or until you hold the world record. Whichever comes first. What game do you choose? There's a tricky answer to this.
Yeah.
There's a way out of this.
Yeah.
Which is just to find anything somebody hasn't speedrun.
Mm-hmm.
Which exist.
Yes.
And then you just get the world record by playing it at normal speed, and then you're free of the curse.
Yeah. Just like literally jump into something new, time a super rushed playthrough of it just to see if you can post it,
yep.
and then boom, you're good. I feel like I feel like Michelle gave us an out by saying it's not a genie question. In the absence of a genie, I will become the genie. In these hypotheticals. Yeah.
If man did not create the djinn, the wishmaster, he would be forced to create the wishmaster.
So that would be the actual answer, so I could move on to something for something for my life. Otherwise it would just be a game that I super enjoy playing, you know, setting goals. So I don't know, Frostpunk or Cities or whatever.
Yeah. So then like games speedrun differently.
Yeah.
You know, there are games that I like a lot that would have crappy speedruns, you know, mm-hmm. because they either have a lot of like unskippable stuff or things that you have to do at the same speed, like you get locked into things.
Yeah.
I think a really fun game to speedrun would be Teardown, which I have watched speedruns of. And the glitch ones are fun because the physics in that game like go real nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And the non-glitch ones are real fun because you just figure out how to do the minimum
mm-hmm.
as quick as possible. And it's really fun to watch people, you know, prep, like mm-hmm. rush prep and then execute something that seems impossible.
Yeah.
In like a second.
Teardown's a good answer because that would have me playing Teardown for a year. So
yeah. And Dan, Teardown's great. How come you didn't warn me in the Wild West expansion how horses work? That's so funny. It's the funniest thing in the fucking world.
It is.
They just reskinned cars as horses. So if you're a horse, you just bust through walls, and like if you jump on the roof, you just like crash through it onto the ground. It's the funniest way to deal with it.
They're indestructible cars.
They're indestructible supercars. Like you can't set them on fire.
Uh-huh.
Like you have to, it's real good.
There are some things that it's better to let you find yourself, Gary.
No, I get it. It's just, it's great. It's very funny. Yeah.
That was you. So yeah. This will be me. Jan writes, hey Cole, what should be the first survival horror video game that I play? I'm into horror movies, demons and cults and cults and cults and cults. I have a PS4. Thanks guys. It does not satisfy demons or cults and cults and cults, but the survival horror game that I also think is the best game would be, Resident Evil 2 remake.
Hmm.
Feel like that would be a no brainer to me.
Yeah. And is actually survival horror.
Yes. Right?
Because like you can say like RE4 remake, mm-hmm. which does have cults and cults and cults, but it's only kind of survival horror.
Yeah.
You know, it probably is a little bit easier to go back to
because
mm-hmm. it maps onto a third person action game.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not, you get into definition games with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Without a doubt, that would be what I would say.
Yeah. Good. I think good answer. Mr. Krieg says, this is my monthly request for season one of The Terror on Unfilmable. Noted.
Yep.
I really want to watch The Terror. It's on the big board. It's hard to justify 10 hours of content for that show.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean it's impossible.
Yeah. I would say don't make this a monthly habit. We will start leaving it off. So.
Oh, we'll start leaving off next month.
Yeah.
This is your time. You got yours in.
Yeah.
Noted. It's something that we want to watch and stuff, but it just, it's, you know,
yeah.
Timing.
Randall asks, either of y'all fuck with Delicious in Dungeon? I know Gary isn't into anime or manga as much, but with how D&D based it is, I think y'all would dig it.
I'm familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought we were at a Barnes & Noble and Liv was looking at it. I was like, this is cute. And I was like, oh, you'd probably like that. I've heard really good things. And she hated it.
Okay.
And Liv is easier to please with media than I am. Non-derogatory. Like that's a Gary problem, not a Liv problem. So I'm a little skeptical.
Yeah.
You know, I still have not tried it, but the volume is just sitting there and I don't dislike manga at all. Like I don't like anime because of how it moves and the voices. Manga gets rid of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, manga's fine to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I just don't like anime.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
curious about it. You know, I feel like if I was going to branch out of non-horror, branch out into non-horror manga, that would probably be one I would try. I don't know. Chainsaw Man.
It's very cute.
Yeah,
it's real cutesy. Delicious in Dungeon. Like it's very kawaii.
Yeah, which is not a deal breaker. It would just be, you know,
very far away from horror. If you wanted a D&D based manga and stuff, there's like Record of the Lotus War, like right there. There are like more straight putt D&D influenced mangas than the cutesy one.
Yes. I was just trying to figure out if I would qualify Chainsaw Man as horror, because that is the last big trendy anime manga. I noticed and, you know, clocked and started reading, and it's good, primarily because it is a great way to see awesome monster designs. You know, so regardless, I'm at Barnes & Noble, I'll probably pick up the first volume and give it a shot. Less interested in the anime just because other stuff fills my watch and time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Vaguely curious for me. KL says, cool. Please name three X-Men who are not starring characters in the 90s cartoon. Gary, please name three different leafed houses. that's an unfair duality there.
So three X-Men that were not starring. I've not seen all of the episodes of the old cartoon. So, you know, Gary, you would have to correct me if any of these were ever in the main cast or what have you. But so X-Men, there's Legion.
Never in the main cast.
Forge.
Never in the main cast.
Zorn.
Yeah, never in the main cast.
Okay, there we go.
Post dates it by a lot. But yeah, great job.
Cool.
I think Forge is in like a little cameo of that, and maybe Legion, but most of those weren't even like, didn't even get like an episode.
No.
Like Archangel and Iceman got episodes. Colossus and Nightcrawler got episodes, but they were never starring characters.
Yeah. Okay, so, cool. Yeah. I did it.
I have no idea about three different leafed houses. expand your knowledge base of what Cole likes. Cole likes things other than House of Leaves. Read us Jake's question.
Yes. Jake writes, newer patron who has been devouring your back catalog. Quick question for Gary, the guppy identified music snob. Growing up by the Wisconsin and Minnesota border, I was a big fan of The Replacements and Husker Du. Are they crap bands?
No.
No, not at all.
Don't be silly. Like Husker Du and The Replacements are goated.
Yeah.
Like fucking both of those bands are great.
Yeah.
I'm a music snob, but not about that. I'm like a music snob about like Owl City. You know, like I like old, you know, old punk and punk adjacent stuff is good.
Yeah. My experiments with playing around and getting custom content for Clone Hero to play drums to has yielded a great number. There are so many replacement tracks.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
Which has been good to, you know, just sit down and, you know, rock out to saw your video. Yeah.
Yeah. The replacements are great. Again, always bring this up. I absolutely admire the absolute big ball move to just name an album Let It Be. I think that's so good. I love it. Both those bands are phenomenal.
Yes.
Let's do our topic. Yes. We have a shorter topic this time because we had more questions and stuff. So we do have some things to say about this, but it's not probably not a super long one. Justin says, long form discussion topic. If you think there's enough to chew on, what makes for good traversal in a game, both short and long distances? When is fast travel employed for good effect? For example, what Metroidvania style powers like dashes and double jumps make it fun to platform from one side of the screen to the other? How good of a boy is Torrent? What games do a good job of tying traversal into their other systems, such as how Dark Souls 1 made exploration, level design, loot, and lore so good that you didn't miss fast travel, only for it to be such a great reward later once you've mastered the space? Love the show. Thanks, gents.
Yeah.
Thank you, Justin.
They gave us plenty to chew on there, and it is appropriate to talk about this smack dab in the middle of having talked about Miles Morales, you know, Spider-Man game, and Dendara, which, you know, the main hook is a different kind of traversal for a Metroidvania.
Yeah. So it's kind of, this is, traversal is one of those things that there was a big reaction against talking about because it was a buzzword for a long time.
It was the ludonarrative dissonance of like 2017, I think.
Yes. Was like talking about traversal, but it never went away as a thing to care about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, of course it matters.
Yeah.
You know, it's a subset of game feel in a lot of ways, you know, but the idea that like, oh, this is not something like it's automatically a disqualifying cliche to care about this always frustrated me.
Yeah.
Because it's one of the things I feel most deeply in my bones when I play a game, not necessarily when it's good. Like I notice it when it's really good, but this is one of the things I think in a game that when it feels bad will absolutely sink an otherwise interesting experience for me.
Yes.
Like absolutely into the ground.
Yeah.
Like this will bury something and salt the earth.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's gone to the rapture. Not me, because your walking speed is slower than anything.
Yeah.
And it's a walking sim, and it just means you waited a long time between incident. And the fans of that game and the developers of it would probably argue that that is to like have you drink it in and think of the philosophical questions. I'm just built different. I don't need that time for it.
It's still a game, you know?
Yeah. Makes me feel like I'm crawling out of my goddamn skin. Like,
yeah. Know. It is possible, you know, to play with your toy a little too much, you break it. There being a backlash though, you know, not every game models a space. Balatro doesn't model a space, but many of them do. How you get across it has to be a primary concern.
Yes. You
know, like spaces exist to be moved in. And this is a real, I know it when I see it. If a game's entire hook is a different way to get around spaces, then it damn well better be worth it. Whatever they do. So
again, tying into Dendara.
Yeah. Yeah. So
to spoil too much, like, I don't hate that game, but I'm not convinced, other than the boss fights, which I think are cool, that traversal was worth the squeeze.
Yes. Dendara, cross-referenced with Bionic Commando, right?
Yes.
Those stand athwart each other, I think, as, you know, two products that actually shed light on each other and why one works and why one maybe isn't necessarily sufficient, you know?
Yeah.
A good example of like a game that is, you know, like, oh, our hook is a different way to get across here. Dishonored, right?
Yeah.
Blink is such a good idea and it changes the way that you interpret those spaces. You know, it is limited, but not, artificially or strictly so. I think that you know, I would lump that in as
on
as
top of
good.
General game feel, like it works with it, like how it intersects with mantling.
Yes.
You know, makes you look at spaces in a different way. Like good traversal will make you look at the spaces you're in.
Yes.
And ideally in like a different way, but sometimes it's enough just to make you look at them at all.
Yes.
You know, I think about games with weak, you know, traversal that at the very least, like do the Hippocratic Oath, like they do no harm, you know, but I look at something like God of War 2018.
Yes. Right?
I don't give a shit how I get around in most levels in that. Like the boat with the conversations, that's good traversal.
Yes.
Because the boat, the, you know, the head is charismatic. Mimiri is charismatic. And the, you know, the, it looks good. And yes. stuff. Walking around the levels, though, because you are just like this block of fighting game guy who just walks around invisible barriers, I'm not thinking about the spaces almost at all.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about them when I have to hit like a target with an axe for a puzzle, but I'm not thinking about like, how do I get from A to B?
Yeah.
In a way. And like good traversal makes you think about that. Like, how am I going to do this?
Yeah.
You know, that's a that's an interesting gameplay concern. You know, so there's so many bits of traversal that just do no harm.
Yeah.
And that generally, like, you move fast enough, there's enough like incident when you're moving fast, you know, that does no harm.
Yeah.
Left 4 Dead has do no harm traversal.
Yes.
You just move real fast. But really good traversal makes you think about the space.
Yeah. I'm going to stop saying space now because we've gone fully into Goop on your Grinch territory.
Sure. Let's Goop
Sorry.
It. Let's recontextualize bodies and Grinches.
It's just, I heard it enough that it started losing meaning. So,
yes. I get it.
Metroidvania style powers that I really like. I love, the slingshotting that you do in Order of Ecclesia.
Oh yeah. The magnesis.
Yes.
That's really good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, weirdly, that feels a little bit like how you move around in Rocket Slime.
Oh yeah.
How you attack, you know, which is like low key fun traversal.
It's almost exactly that. Yeah.
Yeah.
God, you know, Rocket Slime has the same. How good is Rocket Slime?
I know it's phenomenal. It's I can't believe there are Dragon Quest fans who haven't played that game.
Yeah.
Like probably it's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a big thing. You know, getting around that way. I like a double jump, but I do think that another thing that's kind of come up to my mind with Dandara is a little bit of Metroidvania fatigue.
Yes.
That I'm having. And when you get like that doesn't have a double jump, but just kind of tying into Metroidvania fatigue in general, like Blasphemous 2 had a sense of giving you the air dash or double jump and it feeling a little perfunctory.
Yeah.
Getting it should feel super expressive and it should be those powers that feel really good in Metroidvania are also useful for things other than just getting past locked doors.
Yes.
Like they make dodging easier. They give you access to things that feel like you shouldn't get there yet. It's more than just here's a slightly higher ledge that you saw on the first screen and now you can go back there with a double jump. Like those powers are really good when they kind of break the formula and can be used in multiple ways.
Agreed.
I think
other than Torrent, I really don't like a horse. Like, I don't know there. I feel like I've run into more bad horses than good horses in video games. What I do like is a motorcycle.
Motorcycles are real fun.
When you graduate, to being able to, ride a motorcycle in Death Stranding, it is one of the coolest things, you know? And because it is still in this, it is still in the mode of Death Stranding, which is really needing to understand the terrain in order to get through it and not fuck yourself.
Day, you know, 700 or whatever, me praying for a developer who isn't that, you know, the creator to make a game that is concerned with that part of Death Stranding.
Yes.
You know, cause I'm that part sounds very interesting to me.
Yeah.
What else is good traversal? The like I mentioned the do no harm traversal being fast enough. That's not trivial. Like it is kind of a joke that Doom Guy moves supernaturally fast in things. For anything that is kind of gameplay focused like that, that's really good. And when I'm not moving that fast, I feel it. You know, even in a game I otherwise like. You know, just this idea that like the game wants me to kind of jump from moment of incident to moment of incident.
Yes.
You know, you have to make that easy and snappy, you know, and if you're not, you have, that is one of the things I think you have to be the most careful with.
Yeah.
In terms of like playing with fire, like let's slow you down to a crawl. We talked about this, the, you know, the video game character crawls away from the camera.
God damn it.
Scene that's bad traversal.
Yes.
It's a stale, like dead trope. And it is, feels really bad, and developers are using it too willy-nilly.
Yeah.
As a thing, when it feels like absolute dog water.
Yeah.
It's just the worst.
Yeah. Fast travel, the way that that it involves and, you know, it works into this. I agree with you about Dark Souls 1. You know, while also understanding that that is probably, you know, that and, oh gosh, Bloodborne are probably the only worlds that brook that to a certain degree. You know, it's just like, yeah, they nailed it. So fast travel feels a little bit, unnecessary until it is expanded to the point where you want to jump around because you are heading to disparate space, you know, different, disparate places. Right.
In Bloodborne, you can fast travel from the beginning.
Yeah. That's true.
And jump around the, Bloodborne, you have to go through the hub.
Yeah.
Is the big thing, which I think is kind of a bummer, for fast travel. But like the idea of unlocking it like that, I think fast travel a lot of times is also a do no harm mechanic. Like it is just to cut down on bad things rather than to feel good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dark Souls 1 did something very special through having a world that was contained enough and looped enough.
Mm-hmm.
It on itself had enough shortcuts and connections that it could do that trick.
Mm-hmm.
Games since then, even FromSoft games, haven't really tried it.
Right.
You know, to do that. They just let you do it from the jump. I think people sometimes talk about missing having that restriction, but really you have to have the game designed around it for it to matter. Like if they gave you fast travel halfway through Elden Ring, it'd be a nightmare and you have a horse in that game.
Yes.
You know, like that is a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
Like fast travel is good to the degree that the game necessitates it.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm going back and forth a whole lot, I need to be able to fast travel through that. But that's kind of papering over a problem that I'm going back and forth a lot.
Yes.
You're making me do a lot of shuttle runs to go, you know, I think about like Horizon Zero Dawn.
Yes.
Or something. Like I'm going out and clearing three things and I have to go check in with the quest giver.
Yeah.
Between the three things.
Mm-hmm.
If that didn't have fast travel, it would be, you know, suicide inducing.
Yeah.
You know, but it's got that as a do no harm thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's covering up for a problem.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's covering up for a problem that it doesn't entirely make up for.
Yeah. And it didn't need to have in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A game where I don't miss fast travel is Morrowind. You know, like you do have the fairies going up and down the coast, but even those are different. You know, they go to different places almost entirely because the structure of that game is about making you think about directions in relative terms, right?
Yeah.
There is no map. There is no readily accessible fast travel without going to a place, but everybody is super specific about where you need to go. And part of the joy of that game is taking those directions and turning it into understanding of the geography to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then like the bus system feels really good with the world,
yeah,
like the Longstriders or what have you. You know, having traversal be a mechanic is when it rises above do no harm.
Yeah.
You know, like we just talked about Spider-Man. Spider-Man also does that. Like, I don't like fast traveling in Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun to move around. It is skill based. It's expressive, you know, and it's engaging on its own as a thing. That's really rare. Though,
yes,
you know, Crackdown does it. Like Crackdown doesn't have fast travel, but doesn't need it. You know, it has cars and stuff like that. I very rarely used fast travel. I mean, I guess I did sometimes, but didn't use it very often in GTA 5. You know, did not go to a place or switch characters to get to another island to do a side thing. Like I'd usually just go there unless I had to switch characters. Like, and that's because I could drive around. Like getting around was fun and was kind of the point of the game.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
that might be all I have to say about it.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot more to it. It's you know, short topic this time, but it does matter. I reject the idea that because games journalists talked about it too much, that it ceased to matter at some point. Like I hate those cliches like that when it just becomes poisonous to bring up something that absolutely matters to a game just because hacks are bringing it up too much.
Yes.
You know, like just don't be a hack, but also like, fuck, man.
It's
like, of course, how you move around in this field like matters.
Yeah, it's a primary concern.
Yeah, it's how you spend a lot of your time.
Yeah.
You know, in the game, like nothing makes me feel itchier than like a character that just moves really slow for no reason. Like if this character is just slowly pushing a thing across the map or slowly walking across the map, like you're not a Tartakovsky film. Like, you're not slow cinema.
Yeah.
You know, you're a video game, and mm-hmm. you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't do that. And then after that, immediately have me, you know, fighting bosses about nanomachines and shit, you know, looking at you Metal Gear. Yeah. Like, you can't do that. You know, mm-hmm. those are two wildly different tones, and they don't travel together.
Right.
You know, that's even Metal Gear games I like. You mm-hmm. know, Metal Gear Solid 5, good traversal. That horse is fun. Getting around on the D-Walker is fun.
Mm-hmm.
You have to consider the space because there are avenues of approach and everything, and it still just does the crawling through a hallway.
Yeah.
You know, shit. So.
It's the first thing you see. So.
Yep. That's a big for me.
Yeah.
That part specifically. Great game. Yeah, that's going to be it for our topic. Moving on now to responses.
Yeah. Jumping in with Teardown Part 2 responses. Max writes, "Hello, just wanted to write in and say that I really appreciate your Teardown episodes. They do me a great service, as Teardown is one of the few games that give me debilitating motion sickness. It's on a short list of games that I love that I can just never play." That's heartbreaking. I'm very sorry.
Yeah, it happens.
Yep.
You know, you can't control for it. You know, and it's luckily there's just a lot of stuff out there. Other things have to be for you. Mm-hmm. Happy to give a service. Maybe at some point there'll be a mod or something that adjusts the field of view.
Yeah.
Or does something that will fix that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sympathetic. I hate fucking with that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I had to do it. We're doing Lunacid, which I'm loving, but I had to fuck around with the field of view.
Oh, God. Yeah.
It's a real field of view pilled game to make it, you know, and fuck with the amount of Bob to make it not gross me out.
Oh yeah. No, I had to fuck around even with Kingsfield, the Ancient City, before it stopped yes. making me motion sick. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a bummer.
Mm-hmm.
Autumn says, "I got the achievements for taking over an hour on my setup in the first handful of Teardown levels. I like to really take my time. And in part two, I often felt I just couldn't. I find the guard robots and helicopters just make everything annoying. The robots can be killed, but I don't like the risky busy work before I get started with my actual planning. I ended up skipping most levels with them. It made the pace of part two pretty wonky. Any level without them was still great."
This speaks
to, like, whether you want, you know, like, the part two was trying to do different things.
Yes.
You know, and maybe you didn't want those things.
Mm-hmm.
As a thing. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, we were both going to say about the same thing. Like, I can totally understand why somebody who fell in love with Teardown through part one would bristle at those. Just because I also was a little bit in that position. It was a little bit of friction when I first saw those security bot levels to kind of, like, meet the pace of them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I still prefer the heists. To those, while appreciating what Teardown Part 2 is doing. I eventually came around, but it was some buy-in.
What did it for me was playing them back to back.
Yeah.
Like, if I had stopped and gone back to Teardown 2 later, I'd be like, yeah, give me more Teardown, and then it would do all these robot things.
Mm-hmm.
But because I had just played Part 1 a second time,
yeah,
I was open to expanding the formula.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
And I love that skip ability, too.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't mention that in the episode, but Teardown just lets you skip any level you don't want to play.
It's wonderful.
Fucking genius. I don't know. It's really good. You know, with something don't patronize me.
Yeah.
You're not my fucking dad. Like, don't tell me, like, oh no, you have to get through this robot level you don't like to get to the other level you do like. Mm-hmm. Fuck you. I own this product. Like,
yeah. If you didn't give me that option, I would find programs that let me do it.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Or quit the game.
Yep.
You know, the other option is I quit. So mm-hmm. you cannot play chicken with me.
God.
No.
I'm just, you know, and while we leave Teardown to the side here for a little bit,
yep.
I am so happy that you have come around to being as enthusiastic about it as I am.
It's, yeah. I mean, we play in super different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I haven't 100%ed it. I'm probably never going to.
Yeah.
But I really do love it. And I played, you know, I did Art Vandals, and I played the first half of Time Campers.
Yep.
Time Campers. Fell off it for work play.
Yeah, yeah.
But was really enjoying that as well. So I'm looking forward to when they put out their next DLC and we go back to it.
Yes.
You know, in a year or so again as well. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
Yeah.
Great game.
Moving on to The Room responses, Jared writes, "The Room is one of the best dollars that I've spent on a mobile game. It and its sequels have gotten me through some long flights when I didn't want to pick up the book that I brought along. The games are fun and interesting and worth the small amount of time and money spent. I did find myself a little disappointed that finishing the game didn't unlock Tommy Wiseau as a playable character, as the title crossover with the film The Room would have increased my enjoyment many, many times over. There's
How
nothing
you know it didn't.
Stopping you from role-playing as Tommy Wiseau in it.
Yeah, or on a plane.
Yeah.
Like, you can do both. You can role-play as Tommy Wiseau, role-playing as Tommy Wiseau.
I think there are international laws that stop you from Tommy Wiseauing too much.
Because of 9/11. in the security state. Thanks, Bush. Green Day should make an album about it.
I would call Tommy Wiseau the American idiot, but I've got no fucking idea where he's from.
No, it's somewhere though. He's the non-American idiot. Like, the only thing I'm only sure of is that he is not from here, but I don't know where. Just kind of a pan non-American accent.
Yeah.
You know. Thank you, Jared. Mm-hmm. Autumn says, I've been having a lot of fun playing through The Room games with my partner, currently on 2, but I don't care for the horror elements. They feel superfluous and non-threatening. I know I'm not going to be chased by an amnesia monster, so the only thing that can happen is a random jump scare, flashes, and music stings. For a game with similar puzzle difficulty and a fun flavor, I highly recommend the Escape Academy and its DLCs.
Yeah, Escape Academy looks interesting. That's one that ended up on a wish list. Yeah,
I had never played that, but I do like room likes.
Mm-hmm. There's also Escape Simulator, which is pretty good as well. Yeah.
Yeah, that is fun. Even though it's a little word of the wise, that says it's for like players, you know, like 4 to 6 players. The spaces are not made for that.
No, not at all.
It is ludicrous. You will be crowded in with people and not really be able to play. Mm-hmm. Those are 2-player games at best.
Yes.
And work just fine single player.
Yeah. As for the horror stuff, it didn't annoy me that it was there, but I can also see it being kind of superfluous.
I don't think Autumn's wrong. I think that The Room at the time it came out was very revelatory for having a theme and story when it didn't really feel like it needed one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what they went with.
Yeah.
Now in retrospect, that is maybe not as unique.
Yes.
You know, like, we have more puzzle games like that have flavor.
Mm-hmm.
To them. So I was just happy for any flavor.
Yes.
At the time.
Yeah. You know?
But they are superfluous a lot to the actual nuts and bolts.
Mm-hmm. You know. Andrew writes, I played the first 3 Room games all in a row, and that's maybe not the best idea. It's kind of like Fritos, where the bags are either too small to feel satisfied or so big, so they leave you feeling gross. I think I would have wanted exactly 2.5 rooms. But this is sort of my own fault. The puzzles are just the right amount of sensible and clever, 95% of the time, and it's clear they knew how important the feel of tinkering with the little boxes had to be, and the fidget department came through. The plot feels like a copy and paste Lovecraftian mystery, but the actual act of remote navigating labyrinths on some far-off eldritch horror planet is cool stuff. Just learn from my mistake and don't try to shotgun too many rooms at once. And why didn't they call the first one The Box? There are more boxes than rooms. Did Richard Kelly have the copyright? Button was a better name when it was a short story, and also should have stayed a short story.
With all due respect, that last paragraph gets real angry video game nerds. Like what were they thinking?
Yeah.
Upset about Zelda 3 not being called Zelda 3.
And don't get me started on the Rambo movies.
Yeah. it's, you know, they didn't call it The Box because it would have been real silly to be The Box of the Room. You know, the hall.
The Box of the Room Tale.
Yeah. We're the Room of Box Tale. Sometimes things aren't named after the thing that's most frequent inside them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they were building towards a thing.
Yeah.
With rooms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they talk about it in the first one.
They do.
They talk, you know, talk about how there being a lot of rooms.
More rooms once he starts learning to see. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree that these are bad games to chug.
Mm-hmm.
I never chugged them. You know, I played the first one when it came out, and then as they came out, more or less.
Yeah.
You know, and even though I didn't beat all of them, I like fucked with them. You know, bought them when they came out, and fucked with them as they came out. And that was spaced out perfectly for me. You know, and that is a difficult thing. Like, now that they're all out, you have to pace yourself.
Yes. About 1.25 would be the probably the fastest cadence I would suggest on it.
Yes. And even then, it's like, once a year is probably good for me as a non-puzzle sicko. You know, it depends on how varied your gaming diet is,
mm-hmm.
like what you're looking for.
Yeah.
Moving on to Spider-Man Miles Morales responses. Brian says, my best friend is deaf and mute. I met her when I transferred departments at my job, and we hit it off almost immediately, especially since our coworkers weren't really interested in learning to communicate with her and generally treated her pretty badly. I learned the ASL alphabet so I could fingerspell while I started learning words, and it made me start to really appreciate the times I happened to see deaf representation in media. So meeting Haley at the rally was a pleasant surprise, especially when Miles signed back to her. I thought it was a one-off moment, so when she appeared again for a mission, I was extremely happy. Especially since this time it was as Spider-Man, and she got to see a superhero communicating with her. Gameplay-wise, the mission was nothing special, but it became my personal favorite, and I wore the outfit with the scarf she gave you for the rest of the game.
Mm.
Might not fit in here, but I also enjoyed what they did with her segment in 2, and wouldn't have minded one or two more. Yeah, I was going to say, if you hadn't played 2 yet, Brian, 2 really doubles down on that, on all of that. She's a bigger character, and you really get to see, like, Miles gets better at ASL between the first one and second one. It's pretty neat to see how they do that. And then Genki is not quite as good at it. Like, they show different levels of it, which is, seems very impressive to me. There's a Dan Floyd video about that specifically, how hard it is to animate hands.
Yeah.
And how much of a feat, you know, this is.
How much of a hands it is.
Exactly. Oh, yes, exactly. I really like this as well. I liked, you know, you don't see a lot of deaf characters.
Nope.
In a game. It just doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. And it comes as no surprise. We're in favor of representation, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Representation is good. I like representation when it's not just representation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is just like a character who has interest and everything. Like, she's real into art.
Mm-hmm.
She's a staunch community member. It makes sense for her and Miles to get along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I like that she is not just like, what if a deaf girl?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, I love representation plus.
Yes. Yeah.
Specifically. Yeah.
Kyle writes, this game was really disappointing for me. I played Spider-Man 1 when it came out and liked it a lot. But even then, I felt like collecting the collectibles and doing the side content dragged the game out to the point to where it was almost not fun. I worried Miles Morales would feel like that from the get-go, so I waited a few years to get around to playing it. And I was right. And it did feel like a slog almost immediately. Fight room, stealth room, swing fast, repeat. There's not enough that's different from Spider-Man 1 to really justify it, in my opinion. And Spider-Man 1 was, by itself, some fun escapism that overstayed its welcome and wore thin. I'm putting off playing Spider-Man 2 for a long time for the same reason. I also have major complaints with the story. But I feel like it's my fault for wanting more. I understand that a huge corporate product like Spider-Man, like a Spider-Man game, can't have real subversive politics or messaging. But I feel like it's beyond silly in the 2020s to have the quote bad guy in your story be the villain because they want to kill an evil, harmful CEO. And the quote good guy is good because they won't stand for lethal violence. The whole plot of this game made me annoyed and impatient, and I rooted against Spider-Man and for the Tinkerer the entire time. In conclusion, it's time for media to grow up and encourage direct violence against CEOs.
You know, that would be cool.
Uh-huh.
I agree that you're not going to find it in Spider-Man.
Yeah.
You know, or very much of anything.
Yes.
You know, like that's maybe a lot to ask.
Yeah.
You know, from mainstream entertainment.
I'm not sure how much Kyle is exaggerating for what they want to see. If it is sincere, I understand where you're coming from, but also,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I don't like CEOs in real life. Like I, you know, I think about like, oh, if I was a vampire, I'd just kill a lot of motherfuckers who need to go.
Yeah.
You know, if I got superpowers for any reason, it'd be instant vigilante. And then I would die on a dissection table.
Yes.
In Roswell, and it'd be great.
Mm-hmm.
I would have done a lot of good for the world before that, but I don't go to comics for that.
Mm-hmm.
Like I know that's not a comics thing, and it's a little bit, I think it's a little bit oversimplifying it that she just wanted to kill the evil, harmful CEO and the good guy doesn't want him to die.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to blow up the block where he lived.
Yeah.
You know, the thing was going to blow up and kill a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more about collateral damage than it is about saving the guy.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. And this is akin to something that I said in the episode, which is I wish that they spent more time talking about the way that the people of Harlem were trivialized and saying, nobody would care about what happens to them.
It comes up a little bit in the side stuff. You get a bit of that in the side stuff. Like, that is a running theme with all the small business owners and stuff that you help during missions, but it doesn't get foregrounded very much in the media.
Yeah. I get it. As for the slog or the sequence of fight room, stealth room, swing fast, repeat, that to me is just a matter of what dose you're tolerant of. Did I make the saving throw? It was, I did not feel this, but also I didn't go out of my way to go and do collectibles and stuff.
Yeah. Or side stuff. Yeah. You know, I felt this near the end of Spider-Man 2 and Spider-Man 1.
Yeah.
But I feel this towards most video games that go on that long. It's really hard for me to think of a very long game in which, like, this loop doesn't feel that different to me than the loop of most open world games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that is very similar. Like, I did a similarly small collection of verbs, like, in a Horizon Zero Dawn or in Grand Theft Auto 5.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is open world games. This is what they do.
Yeah.
You know, you drive, shoot, chase.
Yeah.
You know, talk.
Which,
this is stealth, fight, swing, you know, talk.
Yeah.
Like, you pick four things and you do them in order, and that's big budget video games.
Yeah. Which isn't to say that it is wrong to dislike them or to.
No.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with the second point. Like, it's not wrong to dislike that this isn't a more woke story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just stuff that for me came with the package.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit like ordering a cheeseburger and being mad that it's not doesn't have more vegetables.
Yeah.
In it. Like, no, it's a cheeseburger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I personally don't find this. I like this cheeseburger a lot. I think this is one of the better cheeseburgers. It's not that I like cheeseburgers more than I like fine dining or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's just to me, it's just a really good cheeseburger.
Yes.
And I also didn't play it. I waited a while between all of my plays.
That's also the thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, so did Kyle. Kyle waited between playing this and everything. But I also, that was enough of a refractory period for me, probably in part because I didn't play a lot of things that are also just do the four things over and over, like Assassin's Creed style.
Yeah.
You know, there's map markers and there's a couple different ways you interface with them. Go to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is what video games have been for a very long time. Climb the tower, you know, do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't done one of those in a long time. I keep my powder dry on those so I can enjoy them, because playing them as an obligation feels like hell to me.
Yeah.
So I try not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's on me. Like, I'm not saying that Kyle is playing them like an obligation or anything. That's just reasons why that worked for me.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Thanks, everybody. We appreciate
thank you. Yeah. We're gonna put in a marker here. We'll be back when we've decided that what game we're gonna do in May.
There's more weeks in May than we thought. Boy, what an eventful break. If you have things to say about April's games, you still can write in by April 15th. Those games are Dandara, Lunacid, and Super Mario World. Write in by April 15th. We'd be happy to read them. And if you have things to say about May's games, which we definitely had planned for a long time and didn't just fill in a slot here at the last minute, write in by May 15th.
Yeah. And those games are, I'm excited about this month, actually. Mm-hmm. I'm excited about most of them, but this one is pretty cool.
This seems sick.
Yeah. So we got four games that month. The first one's going to be Driver San Francisco. That is a demand. That game is wild as hell. It's a driving game with a story. It's like a crime thriller in the 70s, but it's
I have no experience with the drivers.
Yeah.
This is just a patron thing. And I was like, all right, let's give it a shot. You know, I love stretching the format, and I love things that are bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of stretching the format, we're going to keep this iOS, train going a little bit and talk about Plague Inc., the disease simulator, pandemic simulator.
I understand that the pandemic is still going on. I would have wanted to talk about this earlier, but it seems like it would have been in poor taste. And also they added a mode They added a mode where you're fighting against the disease, and a good number of the good portion of the revenue they get is actually like going to disease research. So it is ethically okay to me. And I like that game a lot. So
yeah, I wouldn't worry about the ethics of this. It's, you know, it's a chew toy.
Yeah.
Like you're not causing disease. Like it's not bit mining disease as you play it.
Nobody's on the other side of this. Well, actually they are, but
yeah, you know, people probably died from car accidents as well.
Yes.
And we're going to play a game with a lot of those. So I would put that away.
Yeah. Okay. Third game. This is a Cole pick. I want to talk about Realms of the Haunting.
Yeah, it is very excited about that.
It is a weird game. This is going back a ways. It's like a 90s PC first person horror slash dungeon crawler slash FMV game. That Gary, there's going to be a lot there for you to really enjoy. So
anything we get from that period, like anything we do from the 1998 to 2002 PC corridor, or like 1997, like that corridor is golden to me.
Yes.
I love doing that weird old shit.
Yeah.
So, and there are a premium episode for that month is Tunic.
Yeah.
Tunic, been on our radar for a long time. Mm-hmm. Made by somebody in our Slack, worked on that team.
What?
I remember when that launched. Somebody in the Slack worked on it. And when I say made by, I don't want to give them all the credit.
Yeah.
Somebody who worked on that is on the Slack. I remember when it came out, them talking about it.
Neat.
I've always wanted to play this game. It looked neat. Mm-hmm. I don't like learning languages.
Right.
I don't, you know, I would rather learn a real language. That was some of my hesitation, but I have talked to people who have played it and been like, no, you just, that's if you want to completely read all of the manual and understand it completely.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really need to do that.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, Fez.
Right.
You know, where I have to learn a whole system of runes and everything.
Yeah.
So I'm just looking forward to playing it.
Yeah. And like a Zelda-like, an action RPG where the manual is a part of the mechanics. And that is the way that they are revealed to you is especially cool. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think so.
Yeah.
So yeah. Looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
If you have anything to write in again at stuckfeed.tv/contact, if you are not demographically identical to us and have a project you'd like us to shout out, please send me an email at Gary@duckfeed.tv.
Mm-hmm.
Would appreciate that. We'd be happy to shout you out. Please include pronouns, links, any relevant details.
Yeah.
All very good. Quick shout out to Derek, who wrote the arrangement of the theme song for this episode.
Yes.
Sent that over. Should be subbed in. You should have heard that at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone ever wants to do that, I love it.
Yep.
When people do that, very, very happy to do it. We're happy to highlight them.
Mm-hmm.
I have the chords and stuff for that somewhere. So if you don't feel like starting from zero,
yeah,
you can do that.
It's also, it's in C. So
yeah, it's super in C.
Yeah.
Like most things I write are in C.
Right.
There's a couple of borrowed notes.
Yeah.
You know, from a parallel scale.
Yeah. There's that shift.
There's a B. Yeah. There's a B flat that is not in key.
Mm-hmm.
But generally it's in C.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. But thank you, Derek.
What else? Yeah. Thank you, Derek.
Yeah.
Everybody else, rate, review us, tell people about us, write about us online,
please.
And join us in thanking Gwen.
Thank you, Gwen.
Our
producer edits these episodes, cut off a little break where we definitely didn't just decide to play Gink on the schedule.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. We didn't do a Patreon thing. If you want to hear the episodes about Super Mario World, which is next month's premium episode, or Tunic, which is a premium episode, go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv. You get all of those and all of the past ones as well. We think the price is reasonable, and it only gets more reasonable because you get access to the past content as well.
Yes. Yeah, we think it's a good deal.
Yeah.
I think that's about it.
Think so.
We will. Find a little bit too. Me and Jeremy have gotten together and recorded some Days of Future Cast.
Cool.
So those are going to come out for a little bit. And we're looking forward to talking about X-Men 97. Apologies for that. A couple people asked where that show was. Some health stuff has come up. So we had not been able to record.
Yes.
So that show is kind of in it comes out when it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Thing for a little bit, but we are hopefully going to be able to keep it going for a little bit now.
Yes.
And we're both super excited to talk about X-Men 97.
Mm-hmm.
We'll hope you join us there.
Yeah. I think that's all we got.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, everybody, for listening. Until next time, It's spring in the Northern Hemisphere. Go take a walk.
Yeah, I appreciate it.